Hello, folks. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds. I have Time Magazine for you today, and I'd like to dedicate this program to our listener, Lynn E. in Beaver Dam, who said this was her favorite program. I'm so pleased to hear that, and Lynn, you made my day. So, Time Magazine, this is week one of our biweekly issue, and the cover story is Woman of the Year, who happens to be Nicole Kidman. Championing women on both sides of the camera. In the days after giving birth, Nicole Kidman found herself unable to breastfeed. I was so terrified, asking, "What just happened? Where's my milk?" she says. I remember standing naked in the shower, and my sister helped me. She was my source of strength. She had five children, and she had the wisdom to pass on. Kidman and I are curled up in chairs outside a fireplace in a historic Nashville home not far from the house of the Oscar winner that she shares with her husband, Keith Urban. Their two daughters and a serene poodle named Julian. Kidman is warm and disarmingly inquisitive. She wants to hear about my postpartum experience, too. Perhaps I shouldn't be surprised by the ease of this conversation about vulnerable moments in our lives as women. Kidman, 57, has emotionally exposed herself on screen for decades. In the drama Big Little Lies, she huddled under a towel between shooting scenes of domestic violence. In her latest film, Baby Girl, she growled while masturbating on the floor. She makes all of her scripts with notes about her characters coded for privacy. Then she shreds them. It's too personal, and I want it gone. Filmmakers adore her rawness. People believe if you have power, you don't have to go to a place of vulnerability, says Oscar-winning director Jane Campion, Kidman's longtime friend. A lot of actors don't do that because it's uncomfortable. For Kidman, to be truly open with a director requires a leap of faith. She describes herself as trusting to a fault. That's how I approached all of my relationships. I've been hurt because of that, but I'm still not jaded, she says. I'm delicate, but I'm very giving. The emotions I offer are very real, so I need to know that I'm giving that to you, that you value it. She found that women behind the camera often offer a support reminiscent of how her sister cared for her in those early days after childbirth. And Kidman has made it her mission to use her immense star power to shine a light on emerging directors like Helena Rain, who helmed the bold Baby Girl about a CEO who submits to an intern to a dominant submissive affair. Many actors called out the dearth of opportunities for female filmmakers in the Me Too era, but few followed through on promoting talent. Kidman pledged in 2017 to work with a woman director every 18 months. She has far exceeded her promise, partnering as a producer and actor with 19 women directors in film and TV over the past 8 years. In 2023, fewer than 15% of films released theatrically were directed by women. For those who do receive funding and support, Kidman says, there's undue pressure to be perfect on the first outing. It can be changed, she says, but it can only be changed by actually being in the films of women. With curly strawberry blonde hair and a preternaturally intense stare, Kidman stood out among the 14-year-olds in the Sydney Area Youth Acting School that a 27-year-old Jane Campion once visited to cast her student film. Kidman won the part, but dropped out, fearing she'd look silly in the stocking she had to wear on her head for the costume. Now one of her biggest regrets. But the two stayed in touch, and Kidman consulted Campion after making the jump to Hollywood, where at first her newsmaking marriage to Tom Cruise in 1990 threatened to overshadow her work. By the time she was married to Tom, people in America didn't understand Nicole had a whole career in Australia that was revered, Campion recalls. They just thought she was riding on his career. She was in despair about the roles that she was being offered and wondering how she could change her trajectory. Kidman jumped at the opportunity to work with directors that she admired. A series of performances in the late 90s in Gus Van Sant's To Die, Campion's The Portrait of a Lady, and Sam Mendes' staging of The Blue Room in London proved her bona fides. Kidman has since worked with auteur after auteur. With certain directors call, she doesn't even read the script before saying yes. She gleefully signed on to Lars von Trier's 2003 avant-garde thriller Dogville, Yorgos Lanthimos' unsettling 2017 drama The Killing of a Sacred Deer, and Robert Eggers' bloody 2022 fable The Northman. And of course, Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut. Rain has said that Baby Girl was, in part, inspired by Kidman's performance. In the 1999 movie, her character shares a sexual fantasy that triggers a crisis of masculinity for her husband, played by Cruise. Rain fantasized about Kidman's character carrying out the imagined affair. It's the kind of evolution that Kidman hopes to encourage by opening doors for women. Stanley was dealing with it from the male perspective, and Helena chose to reinterpret it as a woman. Baby Girl, released on Christmas, capped a year of stories about women's sexuality in midlife, including Miranda July's bestseller All Fours, the Anne Hathaway romance The Idea of You, and the Laura Dern movie Lonely Planet, and another Kidman project, A Family Affair, all featured women in their 40s and 50s entangled with younger lovers. It's always been there, it just hasn't been told. Maybe it's threatening, Kidman says. But she is, as Times film critic Stephanie Zakarek posted in her Baby Girl review, in her Don't Give an F era. Kidman doesn't swear, but she admits giggling that the sentiment resonates. I have the philosophy to never fight anything, she says. Surrender. She's come a long way from the teen who was embarrassed to wear a stocking on her head, Campion says. That was a lesson to her later. Be brave. When we meet, Kidman has spent the previous day filming the crime series Scarpetta with Oscar winner Jamie Lee Curtis in Nashville and will fly to Berlin in the evening to wrap season 2 of Nine Perfect Strangers before turning around to promote Mimi Cave's thriller Holland as SXSW in Austin in March. Last year alone, she starred in A Family Affair, the Lulu Wang-directed Expats, Susan Beer's Beach Set, The Perfect Couple, and the CIA drama Lioness, all before Baby Girl hit theaters. Kidman is able to partner with so many female directors, in part, because she never stops working. People go, "You're a superwoman." Kidman says, "I hate it. She doesn't feel super. She gets fatigued, like anyone else, but she's a lifelong people pleaser." She fretted over bringing home perfect grades. If she can't think of the exact right response to a text, she'll ignore it for weeks. She's often compelled to say yes to roles because doing so creates jobs. People work when Nicole works, Curtis says. I'm working because Nicole is working. and she knows it's a privilege. She remembers times when she contemplated quitting, when there was nothing exciting or relevant coming my way, when there was massive criticism or bullying, when your self-esteem is shattered, when you've been hit with some massive loss or grief and go, I don't want to get out of bed. It's too frightening. Campion has witnessed Kidman pull herself out of moments of strife. She's always been a star, and that star has come up and come down. But Nicole knows that in itself, it's not what makes her happy. What makes her happy is her work. Kidman has been on a run of producing and starring in projects about privileged matriarchs whose lives unravel when a secret comes to light. It's not that she's particularly attracted to her glamorous yet guarded characters. Those just happen to be the stories that get green-lighted. I am so open to starring something completely a mess and shattered, she says. Where is it? Give me the material. But the part works. Audiences eat up her rich, icy characters. Campion, art house to the core, concedes that there's value in Kidman's ability to tap into a hungry, predominantly female audience. You can't have power without being commercial, she says. You have to make money. Women want material that fits them, not just macho superheroes. And there's something deceptively progressive in those stories. Prestige roles for women often involved playing the supportive wife. But in her projects, Kidman is the star with accomplished male actors, Alexander Sarsgaard, Liev Schreiber, Antonio Banderas, bolstering her performances. When she says her on-screen husbands have been egoless, I can't help but raise an eyebrow. I've worked with some of the greatest male actors in the world, and they've been so generous. All of them. Is that crazy? Kidman laughs. She wasn't intending to flip a trope on its head. She just did it. Folks, we're going to continue now with the next cover story from this week's Time magazine, and that is America's Aging Workforce, Why the Promise of Retirement is Slipping Out of Reach. And this is by Alana Samuels-Waitsfield in Vermont. Walter Carpenter walks across the ski resort's dining room on a knee that needs to be replaced and a hip that's going bad. Lumbering into the kitchen, he deposits a brown bin of dirty dishes on a counter before heading back out to collect more bowls of half-eaten tomato soup and plates littered with sandwich crusts. 1 foot in front of the other, he jokes, to kitchen prep worker Kim Hopper, 72, as they pass each other. Carpenter, 69, has worked winters at the Mad River Glen ski area in Waitsfield, Vermont, for the past 15 years. 4 times a week, he clocks in around noon and makes $20 per hour, carrying dishes up and down the 3 flights of stairs in the base box, as the kitchen and bar area is called, putting plastic food baskets and metal tongs and soup ladles in their rightful place, loading the industrial dishwasher with cups and bowls. He has peripheral neuropathy, which can leave him without feeling in his feet or legs. Some days, his phone tells him he walks more than 5 miles during his shifts. He never thought he'd be on the job at this age. But without much in retirement savings, Carpenter has no plans to stop. I'm broke and poor and still working at 69, he says, as he once again ascends the carpeted gray stairs with a bin full of dishes, his shoulders slightly stooped, his gray mustache and hair hidden under a baseball cap, and a scruffy Einstein with a slight Boston accent. But at least I'm still here. Mad River Glen, where a daily adult lift ticket costs $115, couldn't run without staffers like Carpenter. If you include part-timers on the ski patrol, the kitchen, crew, and the employees at the retail shop, about half its workers are over 65, according to marketing coordinator Rai Young. That's not entirely surprising in Vermont, where about 26% of residents 65 and older are still working, the highest share in the United States. The state is at the forefront of a national trend. As birth rates decline and the country ages, older people are staying up in the workforce longer. Today, about 19% of people 65% or older in the United States are still working, up from 10% 4 decades ago. They do it for a variety of reasons. Some, like John Mandeville, 75, the executive director of the Central Vermont Council on Aging, finds fulfillment from their jobs and wants to keep going until they can't anymore. Others, like Hopper, the prep cook, have ample retirement savings but still want to be around people and work part-time to stay connected. But about half of workers 65 and older are people like Carpenter, according to Craig Copeland, director of Wealth Benefits Research at the Employee Benefit Research Institute. For one reason or another, an illness, an investment scam, a lifetime of jobs without a pension, or means to save for retirement, they have no choice but to keep working to pay the bills. For these people, the finish line can feel miles away, and every time it draws closer, something moves it back again. Maybe they thought they could get by with their retirement savings until inflation started climbing. Or perhaps they were on track to quit at 65 until the stock market took a dive. Many are like Carpenter, who has worked for 55 years, doing construction, picking apples, running ski lifts, or managing parking lots, but can't retire because most of his jobs were low-paying with meager benefits. There will likely be more of these Americans in the years to come. Half of babies born in the United States in 2007 are projected to live to 103, according to the World Economic Forum. As lifespans lengthen, wages are not keeping up with inflation, and even a decent nest egg may not go far enough. That's especially true as employers have shifted the burden of retirement savings to employees, offering 401ks rather than pensions that promise certain benefits every month. As a result, millions of Americans are going to have to keep working longer. The issue, more than anything, is the high cost of living. Says Mandeville, the Council on Aging director, it's really strained people's retirement budgets. The growing class of people who want to stop working but can't represents a crack in a social compact that assured citizens who worked hard that they could take it easy when they hit 65, if not before. As that crack grows, it will put economic strain on younger generations who have to care for family members, contributing to a growing burden of debt that includes student loans and homeownership. Retirement savings will become one more discouraging thing that young workers can't afford as their costs grow, but their wages do not. 40 years ago, a teacher or a municipal worker or an employee on a manufacturing line was guaranteed a good retirement after putting their time in. Today, more people are working in service industry jobs, but long-time workers like Walter Carpenter cannot afford retirement. "I just have to keep working," he says, as he clears away more dirty dishes. Right now, retirement is a distant dream. In the mornings, Carpenter sits down at a desk in his rent-subsidized apartment in downtown Montpelier and writes letters. He sends missives to newspaper editors about the need for single-payer health care, the problems with the private insurance market, and the importance of gun control, evidence of his political advocacy adorns the otherwise bare walls of his Spartan apartment. There's a picture of him with Senator Bernie Sanders on the steps of the Vermont State Capitol, a letter from former Senator Patrick Leahy, a commendation from former Governor Peter Sumlin, and Carpenter spends hours sitting at his big desk, the main piece of furniture in his couchless living room, writing about the flaws in the American economy. What will happen when, as a friend so aptly put it, I become too frail to work and too poor to live? He wrote in one 2017 letter advocating for state-sponsored retirement benefits. Carpenter became a healthcare advocate in 2006, he says. After he became seriously ill from a liver disease caused by gallstones in the bile ducts, his health insurance company wouldn't approve blood work and radiology tests that were needed to figure out what was wrong, he recalls, forcing him to spend hours and hours on the phone with them advocating for his own treatment. The illness forced him to take a 12-week absence from his job at Stowe Mountain Resort, which was owned by a different company than it is now. He'd worked there since 1995 in a series of jobs that had health insurance and a 401k and paid $10 to $12 per hour. Not a huge sum, but well above a state minimum wage that sat at $7 at the time. But when Carpenter was ready to return to work, he says, the company had gone through a restructuring and his job was gone. He applied for other full-time gigs with benefits, but no one wanted to hire a 52-year-old man with a history of health problems. When people lose good jobs in their 50s, it's common for them to struggle in their 60s and in retirement, says Lisa Berkman, a professor of public policy and epidemiology at the Harvard H. Chan School of Public Health, who has studied older workers. The 50s are a fork decade professionally, Berkman says. Around half of Americans are not working full-time throughout them, and the odds of those people being able to find good jobs in their 60s are low. In contrast, about 80% of people who work full-time through their 50s go on to work in their 60s. When you get to be 60, all the inequality that has accumulated over your lifetime comes into technicolor, Berkman says. So it has been for Carpenter. Since his illness, he has been a seasonal worker, spending winters at Mad River Glen and summers at Vermont Waterbury Center State Park, where he is a park attendant for $22 an hour. The pay isn't bad, but the cost of living in Vermont is higher than the national average. Even with a rent-subsidized apartment, Carpenter's finances are tight. There's $235 he has to pay monthly for his Medicare supplements and the $184 deducted from Social Security for Medicare Part B, plus hundreds of dollars on groceries, his cell phone bill, and expenses for his car, which he drives about 50 miles per day to get to and from work in the winter. The salt does a number on the undercarriage of his 2015 Subaru Forester. One year, he had to dip into his retirement savings to get it in shape for its annual inspection. Carpenter's situation may sound like bad luck, but it is reality for many older Americans. About one in five people over 50 have no retirement savings at all, according to the AARP. The problem is getting worse over time. A 2023 government survey found that 20% of low-income workers had a retirement account balance in 2007, but only 10% had one in 2019. Carpenter has had a colorful life. A self-identified hippie, he studied the flute at the Berklee College of Music, taken trains across Canada, lived in Israel, and survived the eruption of Mount St. Helens in Washington State. The hospitality industry found him when he moved back to the East Coast to care for his aging father, a professor, and started working odd jobs. This, too, is a common problem as more people are thrust into caregiving for aging parents. They'll either have to spend much-needed money for that care or scale back their own work, compromising their fragile finances even further. Carpenter sometimes wishes that he'd thought about retirement earlier, back when he was traveling the world and working part-time jobs. It can be hard sometimes to go to events like his high school reunion and see old schoolmates who are retired and financially secure. He's worried about what will happen over the next decade. That's why he scrimps and saves now, eating the half-priced food at Mad River Glen when he can, subsisting on deli meat from the kitchen. "There's going to be a time when I can't do this anymore," Carpenter says, wiping his hands on the dirty rag tucked in his pants. "So for now, I have to save as much as I can." The sun is setting at Mad River Glen one December evening, and the cafeteria is closing. Customers clump across the vast dining room in their ski boots, ready to go home. In the kitchen, things are slowing down. Workers mop the floor as a boombox blasts the Grateful Dead. Carpenter tosses a green bag of sopping compost into a bin and then bends over to pick up a black plastic bag filled with trash. "You have to know how to lift things in this job," he says, gesturing to the rolling cart full of trash bags and compost. Donning his jacket, he rolls the cart to the elevator, takes it to the ground floor, and drags it outside. It's about 10 degrees, but Carpenter is cheerful as he hoists the trash, recycling, and compost, and tosses them in the proper bins. It's a job for a younger person. When it eventually becomes too difficult, he may ask to become a cashier like his colleague Ron Anderson, 81, who retired from a career in advertising decades ago, then decided to come back to work for camaraderie and the free lift ticket given to all employees. As the nation ages, workers like Carpenter and Anderson will play a greater role in the economy. The Census Bureau predicts that the 65 and older population in the United States will leap from 58 million in 2022 to 82 million by 2050, when the group is projected to make up more than one quarter of the country's population. The share of people in the workforce who are 55 and older is growing, while the proportions of people 16 to 54 has been shrinking since the late 1990s. According to a recent report by the Employee Benefit Research Institute, older workers are becoming more prevalent as the youngest contributors to the economy, people 16 to 24, no longer work as often as they once did, instead pursuing school or other interests. With its high proportion of older workers, Mad River Glen and the state it serves offer a glimpse of America's future. Vermont is the third oldest state in the Union. The number of residents 65 and older has nearly doubled during the past two decades, according to the Vermont State Data Center. The cost of living deters some people from moving there and often sends locals in search of an exit. As employers report worker shortages, state officials are beginning to look for ways to support older workers willing to fill the gaps, says Mandeville, the 75-year-old Council on Aging director. That's how businesses like the Trapp Family Lodge, a resort in Stowe, Vermont, came to put out an ad in 2022 that targeted retirees. "Are you retired and looking for a part-time job to get you out of the house and make play money?" it asked. Bob Schwartz, the resort marketing director, said the idea came as management looked for the low-hanging fruit to beef up our workforce. Flexibility is one of the biggest demands from older workers, says Jenna Trombley, Director of Human Resources at the Clara Martin Center, a nonprofit mental health facility in Vermont. The center has cobbled together a staff by hiring many older people for part-time jobs, agreeing to give them ample time off to travel or visit their grandkids. The center has kept on some long-time workers by allowing them to transfer from full-time to part-time, keeping their knowledge of the organization. It's a win-win all the way around, she says. Japan is a good model for what America might look like if its workforce is increasingly made up of older people. About 80% of Japanese workers want to continue their jobs after retirement, according to the World Economic Forum, and about 1 in 4 people 65 and older were still working in 2022. The country has encouraged companies to help by employing older workers and raising the mandatory retirement age above 60. Technology helps too. Some companies have used robots to help elderly workers continue at jobs that their bodies might not otherwise be able to do. But having everyone work longer isn't the only option. A new type of savings plan spreading around the U.S. could help more people put aside money for retirement. Called an auto IRA, the plan sets aside money from people's paychecks, which it then invests in stocks and bonds. The program costs employees nothing. Their only responsibility is to inform workers about it. This means that people who, for the most part, never had a balance to save can do so, says David John, a senior policy advisor to the AARP, who helped invent the concept. Vermont passed a law allowing auto IRAs in 2023, and 17 other states either have operational auto IRAs or are putting plans in place. In some states, like California, almost all employers have to participate. The program appears to be helping workers grow their retirement savings in the states where it's already operational, according to the few charitable trusts. More than 1 million people have amassed more than $1 billion in assets through such plans since 2018, according to John. In one Pew survey, nearly two-thirds of low-wage workers participating in an auto IRA plan in Illinois said they were satisfied with it. Walter Carpenter supports the idea. In one of his letter-writing campaigns in 2017, he penned a missive to the online publication Vermont Digger, advocating for Vermont to support state-sponsored retirement plans. In the letter, Carpen referred to himself as someone who knows what it means to lose any hope of retirement through circumstances beyond my control. Employers in Vermont can now start offering this type of plan, but unfortunately, Carpenter is unable to avail himself of the benefit now. It's too late for the contributions he's made at this point to amount to much. He reflects on this as he sits in the basement staff dressing room at Mad River Glen, pulling off his apron, swapping his work boots for snow boots, and his jeans and sweatshirt for something clean. For someone who has worked for 55 years, like me, should be able to retire, he says. Instead, he keeps going, one foot in front of the other. He's cleaned the kitchen counters with dish soap, taken out the trash, and stacked chairs on tables. He's ready to go home for the night, but he'll be back tomorrow and for many days after that. Folks, you're listening to Sun Sounds, and this is week one of our biweekly issue of Time Magazine, and we're reading the cover stories. We had our first cover story about Woman of the Year, Nicole Kidman. Now we talked about aging workers, and our next cover story is Net Zero is Not Enough. Does not take long at lunch with Andrew Forrest for him to start becoming less like an Australian mining billionaire and more like a climate activist, meets zealous prosecutor. His rugged features quickly appear not to reflect the arid expanse of Western Australia's Pilbara region, home to the core operations of his $38 billion Fort Rescue iron ore business. Rather, they appear the result of a succession of high-stakes court battles. When we meet at a luxurious Paris brasserie, he speaks passionately about a client that he's been representing for several years, the planet. His case? Corporate bosses must act now, and act fast, to tackle climate change, an argument he delivers with a force and an unrivaled credibility that comes from decades in the carbon-spewing industry. Then, his soup turning cold, he grabs me by my lapels and rattles off the facts as he sees them. Fossil fuel industry executives are culprits, doing all they can to resist a transition to cleaner economy. In other heavy industries, bosses have been lazy and short-sighted, focused on quarterly returns while the world burns. It's time for businesses to stop talking about long-term targets, he tells me, and completely ditch fossil fuels in the coming years rather than in the coming decades. If you think you can't go green, then you're right, he says of his industry colleagues. It's time for you to get off the stage and learn from someone with more talent, more conviction or initiative than you who can lead your company. Critically, this isn't simply talk. At Fort Rescue, the mining behemoth that he founded in 2003, Forrest has begun such transformation. He's building renewable energy projects, purchasing a fleet of electric mining trucks, and trying to catapult green hydrogen to market. It's about character. It's about leadership, he says. Central to Forrest's pitch is a cutting dismissal of the corporate fixation on quarterly returns. His preferred yardstick is the medium term, a long enough time period to make meaningful change, but soon enough that he will actually be around to judge the results. Fort Rescue's $6 billion green investment, for example, is meant to transform his company into an environmentally friendly powerhouse by 2030. We're talking long-term bets, which accrue value on the way, he says. I make it sound simple, but it actually is pretty simple. And then, just as quickly as he had begun, our lunch still unfinished, he stops himself almost mid-thought. Is this enough to start? With his opening arguments delivered and a slap on the back, he's gone in a flash, off to his plane, which was waiting to whisk him to Munich for an engagement with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. That was last February. In the years since, I've watched Forrest take his argument global, traveling with him to Las Vegas, where he announced a $3 billion investment in electric mining trucks, and catching him at conferences in New York and Switzerland, where he cajoled other executives to come aboard his climate quest. The image that emerged is of a rare private sector voice literate in both climate science and financial markets, one willing to make the business case for climate to any audience. The biggest challenge for Forrest isn't one of technical feasibility. If all goes according to plan, actually decarbonizing Fort Rescue will be the easy part. To succeed, he must convince investors, employees, and, perhaps most importantly, other CEOs that going green is worth the risk, financial, reputational, and otherwise. The task couldn't come at a more important time. A wave of populist sentiment has led political leaders to take a step back on climate action, even as the effects of a warming planet become ever more apparent. and grow ever more dire. It's a complex needle to thread. Companies can act on their own, of course, but to do so, they need to be sure they will make money. If he succeeds, Forrest and his project to transform Fort Rescue, where he serves as chairman, could become more than a forceful case for saving the planet. They would become a powerful case study for generating financial dividends by decarbonizing. Failure, on the other hand, would discount other business leaders already nervous about the current political climate. The dangerous part about what we're doing is that if we're not successful, the inspiration for thousands of other companies won't be there, he says. And if we lose money on this in the long term, people say, well, that's philanthropy. Forrest's tale begins with a warning. It's not a pretty story. We're sitting at the dining table of his company's jet, en route to Las Vegas from New York last September, and I've just asked him to recount the story of how he became a climate advocate. Between bites of chicken wings, he rewinds the clock to 2016. He was hiking in a remote part of Australia known as the Kimberley when he fell off a cliff into a gorge. In gory detail, he described how his leg was reversed, stuck pointing in the opposite direction when someone pulled him out of the water. He survived, but it would take years to recover. Forced to take a long break from his hectic day-to-day CEO life, he decided to pursue a PhD in marine ecology. That opened his eyes to the alarming realities of how climate change is harming the oceans, the acidification that is killing marine ecosystems, and the looming risk that oceans will not continue absorbing carbon at the same rates, meaning faster growth of carbon in the atmosphere. He says that the deeper understanding steered him to do everything that we can to stop global warming. It was, in short, a sort of Damascene conversation, brainstorming a mining industry veteran into a climate campaigner. Since then, it's been a whirlwind. The Mindaroo Foundation, founded in 2001 and co-led by Forrest and his wife, from whom he is now separated, has come to fund everything from efforts to address lethal humidity to climate migration. And he has committed deeply to the cause of protecting the oceans. While many of his billionaire counterparts buy yachts to party, Forrest bought one and turned it into a research vessel for ocean scientists. M. Sanjayan, the CEO of Conservation International, talked to Forrest as he fundraised for a new initiative aimed at protecting 5% of the world's oceans. In their phone conversations, Forrest realized that he was soon going to fly over Sanjayan's office in Washington, D.C., so he directed the plane to land. A few hours later, they had dinner near the airport, and Forrest became a top contributor to the $125 million initiative. "He's just larger than life," says Sanjayan, reflecting on that first meeting. Forrest's biggest climate initiative, though, is what he's doing with his own company. Under the mantra of Real Zero, a play on the increasingly controversial phrase net zero, Forrest has said that his company will ditch fossil fuels in its land-based operations entirely by 2030. To make it happen, in 2022, the company launched a $6.2 billion capital investment plan for decarbonizing its primary mining operations in Australia's Pilbara region. That money has funded everything from efficiency to renewable energy generation. When we arrived in Vegas, I saw the unveiling of the effort's crown jewel. Shortly after entering the Las Vegas Convention Center, the exhibition area turned dark. Triumphant music played as drummers and dancers performed. The curtain dropped to reveal a massive electric mining truck capable of hauling 240 metric tons of material. In Forrest's phrasing, his plane could fit inside the truck's bed. It wasn't hyperbole. Even at my height of 6'3", I had to look up to see the top of one of the truck's tires. Forrest said that Fort Rescue, which partnered with a Swiss manufacturer called Liebherr to develop the truck, had already placed an order for 360 vehicles. The deal, valued at nearly $3 billion, sent shockwaves across the industry. It's metamorphic for Fort Rescue, and it's a turning point for the world mining industry. Forrest tells me shareholders are going to say this company is going green and saving us money. The cost savings, switching from diesel fuel to electric mobility, is expected to total in the hundreds and millions of dollars annually. The work has garnered the praise of bigwigs in the climate community. In New York, I watched as Forrest traded compliments with leading climate scientists. In Davos, I sat as he convened the likes of Al Gore and former U.S. climate envoy John Kerry. This guy is willing to make really big bets, and sometimes they pay off. And probably more often than not, they pay off, says Sanjayan. I'm glad he's making it on something that could be transformative for the planet. Yet many remain skeptical, and it's easy to understand why. Mining is one of the dirtiest industries, contributing upwards of 5% of global carbon emissions. And then there are the local effects, including the air pollution that harms nearby communities and concerns about land use rights, given mining often happens on indigenous land. Forrest's penchant for spectacle and disarming warmth can be helpful in making the climate case, but it has also raised some eyebrows in the wider environmental community. He's the type of person who will greet you cheerfully, no matter who you are. In January, at the World Economic Forum annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland, a right-wing provocateur chased him down to press him for an interview. Forrest gracefully put his arm around him and disarmed him, saying, "Get rid of that mic and I'll talk to you. I quite like what you're doing." He jumps on Fox News, keen to make his case even to the most incredulous audiences. When we arrived in Vegas, Gene Simmons, the rock star and KISS frontman, was there to greet him. From Vegas, Simmons joined Forrest on some TV hits to Australia and the 2023 UN Climate Conference in Dubai, where companies rented out hotel ballrooms and event spaces to promote their climate programs. Forrest brought Fort Rescue's 246-foot ammonia-powered ship to the harbor and invited dignitaries on board for cocktails. Indeed, the man is so amiable, so good at making a splash, that it forces you to pause and ask, what's the catch? When Forrest wanted to endorse an organization pushing for a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty, the organization's leaders were unsure how the backing of a mining boss would be received. So they commissioned a study of Fort Rescue's climate and environmental practices, assessing its plans and performance against 63 criteria, including its impact to local communities laid out by the UN. The report found the company to be exceptional, with quibbles so minor that explaining them here would require a crash course in the dense lexicon of climate reporting. He is the real deal, says Sespera Berman, who runs the treaty initiative. If you follow Forrest around long enough, you'll notice that he returns to some of the same arguments and language. In settings with other business leaders, he likes to cite his company's financial returns. "For those who don't know me, my name is Andrew Forrest," he said at his September Climate Forum. "I founded a company which has Australia's highest shareholder return in history." For climate advocates, Forrest citing his mining company's financial performance might sound a bit crass, coming from a billionaire who hops around the world on a private plane. But the message is a critical one. Forrest's financial credentials signal credibility to the private sector, and it is precisely what makes Forrest so unique among his peers. Not only does he articulate a financial case for decarbonizing an industrial company, he also emphasizes that it will happen in the next 5 years. "That's not a goal," he says, "but a hard deadline." He has told facilities managers that if they haven't figured out how to ditch fossil fuels on site by 2030, he will shut down their plants. And he has parted ways with many senior executives who paid lip service to his climate ambition but didn't feel committed to executing it. "We had people that said they were going green," he tells me, "but actually thought it was the dumbest idea ever." Let's just be clear here. The 2030 deadline puts Fort Rescue in a class of its own. Apart from big technology firms, which are easier to decarbonize, large industrial companies that have engaged in the climate conversation have set mid-century targets, and it's assumed that these targets will be met with some reliance on offsets, where companies pay others to cut emissions rather than doing it themselves. Fort Rescue will not use offsets, Forrest says, and when I ask him what it will look like in 20 years, he rejects the question out of hand. 20 years, it's really someone else's problem, he says, so brusquely that he later apologetically acknowledged his harsh tone. Making such a bold commitment to climate at a publicly traded company requires a bullish financial case, and there are several components to his arguments. For his electrification drive, think of the mining trucks or mining site operations, the promise is savings as the upfront cost reduces fuel usage over the long term. It also brings with it a knock-on financial benefit, creating green iron ore and green steel, and it will give Fort Rescue a leg up selling its product as customers look to decarbonize their own products. And doing the legwork now in developing this technology will create a new revenue stream for the company as it sells it to others. The most significant of those technologies is green hydrogen, a fuel created by splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen using an electric current powered by renewable energy. This green fuel can replace fossil fuels in heavy industry and transportation. The company is spending hundreds of millions of dollars a year to build out green hydrogen production facilities in Australia, the U.S., Norway, and Brazil. When I last caught up with Forrest in January, the global mood around climate had shifted dramatically since we first met a year prior. Donald Trump was back in the White House, and the private sector enthusiasm around all things climate, already tapering last year, had become even more muted. Driving down the promenade in Davos, Forrest betrayed some frustration with his counterparts who have used the zeitgeist shift to change course. At many firms, climate and ESG, short for Environment, Social, and Governance strategies, were being rebranded using more palatable terms like resilience or energy security, even as the core of the work continues. At others, those commitments have been walked back entirely to save money and save face. It's letting the wolves out of the cages who never wanted to do anything for the climate anyway, and they're saying that they now don't have to, he says. Well, all right, Let's just see how that works out for you. Forrest remains defiant. If the Republican-controlled government in Washington nixes clean technology tax incentives, you'll see hundreds of billions of dollars extracted out of the U.S. economy, including ours, he tells me. And he has the backing of political leaders in Australia, where Fort Rescue is headquartered. It's absolutely critical, says Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese of Forest Climate Efforts. But while policy shifts may change the dynamics of specific projects, the direction of travel won't change. Fort Rescue's plan is rooted in sound economics, he says, and that's not changing. We're staying the course, he tells me. Real zero is completely bankable. And no matter what President Trump does, global markets changing, increasingly favoring products that are cleaner and resilient to climate risks, whether they are created by the physical world or by our response to them. But assessing the speed of those changes and then shifting your business to reflect that speed is a very challenging task, even for the most climate-savvy executives. Forrest's bet is that being first will pay huge dividends. It's a simple concept, but few have been bold enough to spend billions to test it. For the sake of the planet and everyone who lives on it, let's hope that he's right. Well, folks, that does it for today. I hope you've enjoyed hearing the cover stories from this week's Time magazine. Stay tuned for next week when I will read you the brief and the view sections of this biweekly issue. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for SunSounds. I've enjoyed reading for you today, and I'll look forward to next time. Have a great week. Bye now.